This is Phil Farron.
And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It's been a good week. We've got some things done. I'm heading into the weekend. So all is well. All is well. We got some good things done. Lots of stuff going on. They have moved. My bank, which used to have an ATM right by my major client, has decided to discontinue that ATM. So I've got some checks to deposit. So I'm going to head over to another branch of this bank and use it over there. So I'm going to have to sign off for a second once I get over there. But that's the glory of the pause button. It's like no time ever transpired. So anyways, work is going well, we're getting things accomplished, setting things up, knocking them down, taking care of problems. Worked through today a fairly, it's not horrifically complicated, but a fairly complicated little problem and got it calculating correctly. I don't know how in the world humans have ever done this because it is a bit beyond the pale to expect humans to do these kinds of calculations over and over and over and over again and get them done accurately. But the monkeys are trained at this point, so ta-da. So that's good. I am working on book 15. Book 14 is out to the beta readers, and I've already heard back from two of them already. They're finished up, and another one told me today that they had gotten started. So, you know, all of that is well. We're puttering along. Book 15, I think, is going fine. You know, it's in the early days of it. But I think we're doing okay on book 15. And then the big thing happening on costumes right now, tomorrow, is National Ellis Island Family History Day. And it's a day specifically to be celebrated by those who had relatives that came through Ellis Island, or to investigate whether or not they had relatives who came through Ellis Island. I happen to know from other research that relatives have done that my grandfather came through Ellis Island. And it's amazing that it is my grandfather, not my great-grandfather or my great-great-grandfather, but it is my grandfather who came over from Northern Italy, came through Ellis Island in 1898. Ellis Island opened in 1892, I think, and he came through in 1898 for the first time. I had done some research last year when we did Ellis Island Family History Day and found the page. Actually, I did it before that, but I found the page that they signed him in Ellis Island in 1898. So obviously he lived long enough to sire someone who lived long enough to sire me and be able to put that within range. That just seems amazing. If I recall correctly, at the time he told them that he was like 22, but according to the information I have, he was actually younger. I think he was in his late teens at that point. But he had some relatives who I think lived in New Jersey, and so he stayed with them and worked for about a decade and then went home to collect his bride, and that's a whole other big story. Very, very interesting. Anyways, that's tomorrow. A week from tomorrow is Talk Like Shakespeare Day. And of course, I've been working on that costume. I think that's coming along and it's fine. It's not going to be a cakewalk. And hopefully this weekend I start assembling pieces. and I think I will have enough finishing done by this weekend that I can actually physically start assembling the pieces and getting things fitted. I think it's going to be fine. It'll be fine. If nothing else, people will laugh, but it will be fine. It's been a fun little project. I've had some late nights, but not too bad. Not too bad. Not like some of the projects I've had. So I don't, when I did the Frankenkitty, Hello Frankenkitty, I didn't know what, you know, I didn't have the whole picture. And so I was just going like crazy. And so for next year, I'll make some adjustments. But that Hello Frankenkitty, I was up on a Thursday night going into Friday morning. I was up to like 2:30 in the morning where I finally got it to place where I thought this will work close enough. And so closed it up at that point. I don't think I'm going to have a repeat of that this time. I think it feels like it's on target. With both of those things, though, with the book, the new book, 15, and then the costumes, it's really kind of the same feeling between them. I'm just wondering if I can just jabber and do this at the same time. I probably can't. I'm here at the ATM, and I'm just going to look for a pen real quick. It's both kind of a similar feel because most of the time, I just start off with these things with some vague idea. There's just some vague idea as to what I would like to see happen. And there are many unknowns. And my policy is, instead, when it's something like this, when it's, you know, something that's my creative endeavor, as opposed to trying to nail down all the pieces of things that I have never done before, you know, and trying to be certain that I can succeed at this, yada, yada, yada. Instead of doing that, I just launch into it. And we just see what happens, because it feels like a game. And so what I'm doing is I'm playing the game. And part of playing the game is to simply understand that you have a step in front of you, and you take that step, and then you see what happens, and then you take the next step. And you just keep taking steps. And then when you get to the end of it, you look back and go, well, look at that. That was pretty amazing. And so it's like, I think I mentioned last week, you know, I started this book and you kind of have a vague idea of what you want to see happen. And I get into it. And then as I'm writing along, there's like, oh, I guess that's doing that. And so then it goes in that direction and then you build on that. And then it goes in another direction and you build on that. And honestly, in book 15, there are whole major sections of it where I haven't lived it yet. And so we're just gonna figure it out as we go. And somehow it all works out. And what's really interesting is when you drop things in at the front of the book that you don't know where they're going. But you just drop them in because, well, that kind of seems like an interesting thing to do, you know? And so you just drop it in. And then you get to the end of the book and you think, oh, that's what that was for. And then, you know, you do it. Now, some people will tell you that that's just a coincidence, that it wouldn't have mattered what you dropped into the beginning of the book. You would have always figured out a way to make it come around in the end or come around in the next couple of books. But you know, it doesn't feel like that. It feels like someone is saying, hey, why don't you try putting this in there, you know, and you put that in there, and okay, and then you could put this in here, and then you get farther down the road, and then you realize, oh, wait a minute, that ties back to that, you know, and then it's like, hey, there we go. And that stuff is just fun. That stuff is just very, very fun when that happens. And it's all part of that dialogue. And it's all part of that game and that adventure of moving forward, step at a time, and then realizing that someone has your back, someone's watching out for you, and someone's guiding you. It's like I told a friend today, that doesn't mean that the work gets done automatically. You still have to do the work. And it's like, you know, this costume that I'm working on, there's still a lot of small kind of issues that I don't know how I'm going to get resolved and what I should do in those things, but the basics of it is there, and the idea was there, and at each step of the way, I've known just enough to do the next step, but there have been things like the sleeves. I wasn't sure how I was going to do the sleeves, and I didn't know how much time they were going to take, and since I didn't know how much time they were going to take, it was hard to tell, am I really on schedule or not, and, you know, once I get closer to needing to make the sleeves, then I wake up in the morning and I think, oh, I could just do them that way. So that would get me where I need to be, and that would be fast. I could get that done fast. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, okay, I think we are going to make this. But there's not a ton of planning for some of this stuff. It's just, sure, let's try it. And yet, in the midst of all that, there is a certain trust that is developed where you understand that you have a partnership, where, as Paul says, for we are his workmanship. We have these secret treasures within us, and that we are his. We are his creative endeavor, workmanship. We are his creative poem. And there's this sense of he is writing us, but we are writing us as well. And as you're moving through life and you develop this trust, and as you see over and over how things work out. You know, honestly, I've been working on this Shakespeare costume for 4 weeks now. A lot of uncertainties, not knowing where things were going to land, how they would fall, what it would look like, if this would just be a complete fail, or... But at every step of the way, you just take one step at a time, and you don't spend a lot of time wasting time on nervous or anxious energy. You just say, well, what do I have to do today? And how much time is that going to take today to get that done? And I'll do what I can. And I'll just be faithful in the individual steps. I'll be faithful in spending my time as best I can. And then leave the rest. I'll leave the rest up to God, that he'll guide me, that he'll help me to get this done on time, so that I'll be ready. You know, and it's good. It's just good, because when you actually do hit it and you are ready on time, you know, you're like, booyah, got another one down. And then you have that in your store of things that you've accomplished in your life and move on to the next thing. So it's really a fascinating dance. It's a fascinating life. It's a fascinating adventure, because there's just so much that I don't know. But as I just move forward, it is revealed. And it feels like it was planned all the time. It feels like, oh, well, of course you were going to end up there. Because that's whatever. So, good stuff. Good stuff. It's fine. Today, I had come across, I've mentioned Brent Weinstein and Boy, I hope this is correct. Heather Hain. I should really look that up. Husband and wife. Very intelligent. Both evolutionary biologists. They think very deeply about things. They try to be very serious as to how they approach their communications. I appreciate that very much. They are very much aware of the trending and things that are going on. They have seen firsthand how easy it is for religious thought, whether it's diehard Trump supporters or diehard woke individuals, you know, critical race theory people. They've seen firsthand how those religious belief systems can scale out and cause troubles and create tribalism and incite violence and those things. And so they're always kind of thinking and reflecting, and they're trying to stay rational. And I very much appreciate that about them. And I came across a discussion that they had with each other this last week. You know, and they were talking about advertising. And of course, since I had just recently done a podcast on Facebook and advertising and the engine that is driving all that, I thought, oh, I wonder what they're talking about here. And it was interesting because a lot of what they were talking about really resonated with me. Part of that is they started off by discussing their own personal philosophy of how they're trying to accomplish what they're trying to accomplish. Mind you, right now they're getting, I believe, most of their income simply from doing their podcast and being supported on Patreon. They said that they have had many offers to endorse products, but they try to be very, very careful. And in fact, Brent Weinstein was talking about the fact that he potentially thinks that advertising might be the root of all evil. because we go to bed and we get up in the morning and just the entire day we're bombarded with advertising. Now, if it was a certain type of advertising that made the effort to appeal to our rationality and present cost-benefit analysis on these products and why we should buy these products based on the benefit that it would provide for us and that it's been shown to provide across a wide variety of experiments and trials, that would be one thing. But of course, advertising isn't that typically. And that led to he and Heather Hain getting into a discussion about the use of advertising in nature, how that certain animals advertised their toxicity with bright colors, basically saying, don't eat me, because if you do, I have poisons and I will kill you. and how that is something that happens, and yet there are other animals who develop these bright spots, taking advantage of the fact that someone else invested a lot of time and energy into developing these poisons that they carry in their body. I'm going to shut off the car. I'm here at the church. I'm going to be doing the video, so I'm just going to finish this up here, and then I'm going to hit it. You know, the design somehow doesn't want to invest as much time and energy into building those toxins, so they just get spots pretending that they're poisonous. And so there is within advertising a couple of different ways that you can go about it. You can do the whole cost-benefit rational, et cetera, type situation, which hardly anybody does. Or you can base your advertising on perception. And they went into a discussion then about perception and how that if advertising is based on perception, then once you do that, you open the door to deceit. So they said, so really my point is, so advertising is all in perception mediated selection space because it's inherently perception mediated. That is to say, whether you have succeed or failed is based on the perception of some other individual. Are you hiding from them or are you augmenting some characteristic, whether or not it works? It depends on their perception. The point is, when perception is the mechanism through which selection is acting, deception is a huge fraction of the game. Because then people can fake it. Then people can present you an image, present you an outcome that might not be true, trying to motivate you into doing that. I had a friend today when I was chatting with him about this, and he said that was one of the things that he hated about his marketing class, was that in his marketing class in college, they were constantly talking about how to manipulate emotions. And how that men think they don't have emotions, and so if you try to manipulate them directly, then they're going to refuse that. But you use all these techniques to get around the fact that they'll be perceiving that you're trying to manipulate their emotion. He said, I just hated all that stuff. You know, but that is advertising. So they started talking about the fact, they said, we will end up vouching but just to say that we will end up vouching for things here that are things that we might actually do, and we're going to do so without qualms. And in some sense, I think that viewing this is the reason that I joke about being advertising being the root of all evil, because it becomes a driving force any place it is the mechanism through which things are paid for you as the viewer, where you as the viewer become the product. So if you're providing anything, and the only way that you're providing that is because you are allowing yourself to be used in the advertising mechanisms, then inevitably the ability to get people to respond through advertising becomes the thing, because that's how you are continuing to quote unquote exist. The Windfall series that I'm working on has as one of its core principles, every item, every entity, once it becomes aware of its own existence, has a first principle that eclipses all others. How do I continue to exist? So if your existence in the media space is dependent on advertising, then you are going to tailor your existence in the media space, tailor your performance in the media space, so that you'll make yourself more conducive to advertisers who want to use those who you bring to the table and to exploit them. So, rightly so, they said we want to be very, very careful about how we do advertising. And in fact, Heather Haying then went on to relate anecdotes about how much, even then as she was investigating, how much the content of magazines is controlled by what the advertisers wanted. So she said there's all kinds of things where if an advertiser is going to advertise in a magazine, then they want their product mentioned in the articles, or you know, if there's cleaning products, that some of the cleaning products said, well, They need to be adjacent to children or fashion editorial or maiden form, which is the maker of bras and other apparels, required that no negative content be adjacent to the ads, including anything relating to illness or disillusionedness or large fashion sizes, or how De Beers prohibited magazines from placing its ads next to hard news or anti-love or romantically themed materials, you know. So they said, no, we don't want our... And so all of a sudden now, the advertisers are coming in and you're not just selling them an ad, but you're selling them the positioning of that ad and perhaps some mentioning in articles, because you're trying to bypass the fact that the user, the viewer, the consumer of this information is going to look at the ad and realize that's an ad, but they're not going to realize that the content that surrounds that ad has been sculpted as well to where that content will not interfere with whatever emotional messaging the ad is trying to deliver. You know, it's interesting. And they go in and talk about all of this and other things as well. But it's fascinating. And yet, at the same time, to me, it's interesting to hear... that, you know, Brent Weinstein was saying that part of what is going on with the derangement of the West, and I really think, you know, it's a psychosis of sorts that we are watching, where the loss of the ability to track arguments and to extrapolate reasonably, and all of that is actually being driven by the fact that so much of the landscape through which we are interacting is advertising driven. And my point is that probably means we are getting content that looks very different than we would otherwise be getting, not because human beings don't want higher quality nuanced content, but because advertisers do not want us in general in our conscious mind. They want us in our subconscious mind, where we can't necessarily track that we're being manipulated and persuaded of things that might not be factual. So the idea is factual content that caused you to think might be very desirable from the point of view of the consumer of the channel, but it would not be desirable from the point of view of an advertiser that really wants you in something, you know, just above a sleep level of awareness. I mean, that's absolutely true, I think. And so in our case, I think the answer is that we don't want any ad for which the advertiser is looking to have you in your conscious mind evaluating these claims or whether or not it adds up to you at a conscious level. That's the desire that is only a fraction of advertiser that is not looking to catch you off guard. So they're trying to say, you know, they're trying to be very careful about what they're doing. And I think there's honor in that. And one of the things that I haven't had to deal with yet that I may need to deal with at some point in the future. And he goes on, they go on to talk about advertising to children, and that's all good. It's all good. It's very interesting. The clip that I was looking at was off of YouTube. It's called History and Impact of Advertising from live stream number 47, Brett Weinstein and Heather Hayden. I think it's Hayden. I should look that up. And I think all of that's good and it's true, but it doesn't explain necessarily why it's so destructive. I think there's no question that it is a component in what is causing the derangement and the inability to hold rational thought. I think it is very much a planned effort to keep people from thinking rationally and to keep them emotionally manipulated. because it's much easier to convince people to do things that you want them to do if you manipulate them emotionally. I was just watching a secretly recorded video from a high-level executive, supposedly from one of these news organizations, that was talking about the fact that, oh yeah, we try to promote fear because, you know, fear keeps people coming back and wanting more and listening for more. And so there is this recognition in Western society, in advertising, in social media, that emotionally manipulating people is a way that you can more easily control their behavior. And again, I think the essential thing to note here is to answer the question, why? Why is it easier? Why do you appear to have an ally that will cooperate with you when you approach and you try to entice humans with more emotional thought than rational thought? If we are truly rational creatures, why would it be more enticing to us to respond to those things that are emotionally driven as opposed to those things that are rationally driven? And I had one friend say, well, that's because we're social creatures. Okay, that may be a part of it. But if it was just that we are social creatures, why wouldn't we be drawn to more beauty and kindness and gentleness and wonder and curiosity? Why wouldn't we be drawn to those types of emotion as opposed to the fact that we are definitely drawn towards the more destructive elements? And why is that? And I continue to maintain that the reason that we are drawn to those more destructive elements is because we are being pushed towards those more destructive elements. And some of it may all seem innocent and not that big of a deal, but I would suggest that all these things do layer on top of each other if you aren't aware of what's happening. So you have these ads where these people are in this car and, you know, there's these young people all together and they're laughing and carrying on, or there's a family in there and everyone's talking and they're looking, knowing each other as this car makes its way down the road. And it has, you know, it's a beautiful car and it has leather interior and it's just so many amenities and look how comfortable I am. And what's really being sold there is that your life will just be so much happier and so much more content if you just have this car, which is, of course, ridiculous. Car can't bring you contentment. It might in the short term, because you'll feel so special about yourself once you have that car. But the question is, why do you feel like you need that car to make yourself more special? Why do you feel like when you look at this family that seems so content in this car, there's a yearning for that? And then why does that wear off? And then why do you become discontented? And I would maintain it's all flesh. Because when you're looking at that ad and you feel a drawing to that car, you're not thinking, well, this is a great car because of the cost-benefit analysis in that, because of the safety features on it, and this is a car that I can buy. It has good resale value and it has, you know, all that rational stuff. You're just looking at this family, and if you have difficulties in your family, then your flesh is going to go, wow, look at those people. Look how nice. Oh, wow, they are really enjoying yourself. It's too bad that you can't enjoy yourself to that, because, you know, you deserve that car. I mean, the flesh is just needling you, trying to get you to move that direction. And the reason that it's needling you, trying to get you to move that direction, is because it knows the car is not the solution. But it's going to push you towards that car, And then if you buy that car to just make you think the car is the solution, to make you unsatisfied in your life, and then if you buy that car, it's going to tell you, first of all, wow, such a great car. This is such a great car. This is such a great car. You did such a great thing. And build you up. And then once it gets you built up, it's going to go, you know, this was really an expensive, stupid mistake for you to buy this car. Because that's what the flesh is constantly doing. It's constantly setting you up and knocking you down and trying to bring back every time things didn't work out in life and everything, you know, just keep you in a state of mind where your worldview is warped and distorted and your mind becomes deranged. That's what it's trying to do. Because if it can do that, it gets you ever closer to destruction. So, yes, we are inundated with advertising. Is it the advertising that's actually causing the derangement? Is it the advertising that is the root of all evil? I don't think so, no. I think what is the root of all evil is our flesh and what our flesh does with those things. And then we respond. And when we respond, we become the root of our own evil. Because as long as we're cooperating with the flesh, we're just getting one step closer to destruction. And again, how we can tell whether we're moving towards destruction is to simply compare it against our guardrails. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Compare it against those guardrails, and if you feel something like, oh, I really wish I had that car, I deserve that car, okay, that's not in there anyways. Envy is not in there. Greed is not in those formulas. It's not in the guardrails. And just remember, when you look at that advertising, when it comes across, just remember, those advertisers are doing their best to manipulate you into looking and clicking. And you can even click. That doesn't mean you need to buy something. Because if you start feeling that, oh, if I just get this, then my life, you just say, no, that's not going to really change my life. And what you really need to do is saying, is this something I actually need right now? Is this something that I can use to leverage, to gain me more time, you know, to earn me some money, to do things that have real qualitative benefit, even quantitative benefit in my life? Or is it something that I'm just going to grab and throw away later? And do I really need it then? So as long as we're engaging our rational minds and staying within the rational space and listening to Jesus, frankly, you know, we can be bombarded with advertising all day long and it's not going to derange us. But if you just let yourself slop through life and don't really pay attention to what the advertisers are trying to do to you, then yes, all of that will bring you one step closer to destruction because your flesh will use it all as tools. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it to the church, and I'm going into work on the video. Have a great weekend, everyone.